Good afternoon, and welcome to the 494th meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations. We're getting right up there to around the 500 mark, so it'll be interesting to be able to announce that it was 500. The forum has been meeting monthly since 1983 to hear from an invited speaker on a topic central to U.S. foreign policy. Today we're pleased to have Sir Masoud Ahmad here to speak on world development and the U.S. role. Sir Masoud Ahmad is the President Emeritus of the Center for Global Development. He joined the center in January of 2017, capping a 35-year career driving economic development policy initiatives relating to debt, aid effectiveness, trade, and global economic prospects at major international institutions. Mr. Ahmad joined the Center for Global Development from the International Monetary Fund, where he served for 8 years as director of the Middle East and Central Asia Department, earning praise from the managing director, Christine Lagarde, as a visionary leader. In that role, he oversaw the fund's operation in 32 countries and managed relationships with key national and regional policymakers and stakeholders. In previous years, he also served as the IMF's Director of External Relations and Deputy Director of the Policy Development and Review Department. Then before that, from 2003 to 2006, Mr. Ahmad served as Director General for Policy and International at the UK government's Department for International Development. In that role, he was responsible for advising UK ministers on development issues and overseeing the UK's relationship with international development institutions such as the World Bank. From 1979 to 2000, he worked at the World Bank in various management and economic positions, rising to become Vice President for Poverty Reduction and Economic Management. So he's really been a member, an important member, of the key development organizations in the world. Currently, he is a political advisor of the G20 High-Level Independent Experts Group on Strengthening Multilateral Development Banks, and he's the co-chair of the World Economic Forum Global Future Council's Future of Growth Committee. It's a hard one to say. Born and raised in Pakistan, Mr. Ahmad moved to London in 1971 to study at the London School of Economics, where he obtained a bachelor's degree with honors, as well as a master's degree in economics with distinction. In January 2003, he received a knighthood from the United Kingdom government for his services to international development. Sir Masoud, welcome to the Midcoast Forum.
Thank you. Well, thank you. Thank you very much, George, for that. Thank you all for taking the time to be here. George, I was going to thank you for having laid on that great weather. But I have to say, it's been wonderful 2 days. It's our first trip to Maine, certainly not the last. The title of today's session is World Development and the U.S. Role. I want to start off by just making one point about each of those two. The first thing I think about world development, it's useful to remind ourselves that in our lifetimes, certainly in my lifetime, and especially in the generation, the 25 years between 1990, fall of the Berlin Wall, through to 2015, more of the world has seen more of an improvement in their living standards and health conditions than ever before in human history. And it's just something that we kind of take for granted, but it's really quite amazing. In 1990, which is not all that far back, 4 households out of every 10 in developing countries lived in extreme poverty. By 2015, it was 1 in 10. Life expectancy went up in that generation. Average life expectancy for people in low-income countries went up 12 years. In the previous generations, it had been an average of 4 years. The number of children who die before they reach the age of 5, the share went down by half. Almost all the kids now go to school, primary school. So there really has been a tremendous improvement. Now, not everywhere, it's not even, and a lot of the global numbers are driven by the transformation of China, because China is so big and there was so much progress. But if you look outside of China, you see the same things. South Asia, which has India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, big and populous countries, you see there similar progress. Extreme poverty fell from 1 in 2. So every other person was living in extreme poverty in 1990 to 1 in 6. 1 in 6 is still 1 too many, but you can see the progress. Even if you look in sub-Saharan Africa, and George, you mentioned that the next session is going to be about U.S. relations with Africa. Africa's been the place which has lagged the most in terms of progress, but there are countries in Africa, you know, Ethiopia, Rwanda, Ghana, Tanzania, where per capita incomes during that period went up threefold. So you can see a lot of progress in the world. Now, let's go to the second part. How much of this can be attributed to the U.S.? Well, I think the first thing we need to remember is that the single most important driver of progress is what happens within each country. It's how they manage their politics, how they manage their economy, how they manage their investment in their next generations that drives outcomes more than anything else. But the actions of the rest of the world do make a difference. And the U.S. is the largest economy in the world, has a disproportionate impact on those actions. And I would say there are two ways in which the U.S. made a big contribution to that set of outcomes that I just described. First, the U.S. has been by far the largest provider of direct support in terms of development assistance programs to other countries. So the U.S. provided, last count, 60-some billion dollars through its programs, and that's much larger than the second largest, which was Germany at around 40. The UK came in third at about 20. So US is a big provider of technical and financial support. And you know, people can talk about how well those programs were run, whether they were cost efficient or not, but net impact was clearly hugely positive in improving people's lives. PEPFAR, many of you will remember the president's emergency program for AIDS relief started by George Bush, and PEPFAR saved 26 million lives. So clearly there's a direct role the U.S. played. But there's maybe an even more important role that the U.S. played. And that was as the principal architect and anchor of the global system of rules and institutions which enabled countries that had the right policies to profit from a more open trading system, to participate in the world economy, and to grow through that, and to bring prosperity from participating in the world economy. And the U.S. was the keeper of that system. So that was a bit of an indirect role, and you know, sounds a little self-centered, but I would say there was a third role, which was that in some ways it was a model for the rest of the world. When countries are developing, they like to think of, well, where would we like to get to? And the U.S. economy has always been for many countries and many people, individuals and companies, a sort of model of a role model where you'd want to get to. Now, we look like we're at a turning point. The U.S. seems to be, last year, certainly people thought it was retreating from both of these roles. So some people in this room may have directly been involved with USAID and the dismantling of USAID and all the companies that work with it. And the numbers still coming in, but the OECD, which puts out these numbers on a regular basis, says the U.S. cut its official assistance in 2025 by about half, a little more than half. Again, lots of different estimates of what that means in terms of the human cost. But some of my colleagues at the Center for Global Development estimated that just the cut in U.S. aid health programs probably cost between 500,000 and 1 million lives. So there was clearly a direct impact of those cuts. More broadly, as part of a sort of pulling back from being the keeper of the international system of rules and institutions that it had created over many decades, the U.S. withdrew from 60-plus agencies, many of which were involved, international agencies, many of which were involved with promoting development. So there's a bit of a rethinking on what does all this lead to. Now, come back to the U.S., but it's useful to say one more thing there, which is that what the U.S. did in a way much more dramatically, much larger scale, is actually happening across Europe already. So for the last few years, the UK, European countries, France, Germany, Sweden, which had all been very active in promoting development cooperation, were cutting back on their own development assistance. The UK's actually cut back its development assistance by a greater percentage than the US has. They just did it more quietly and over a longer period. More than that, I think the whole model of development cooperation, which started around 1990, which was basically defined by the objective of eradicating global poverty and disease, and is guided by using evidence and technocrats and giving them a budget to get on with it, more or less insulated from the other business of government, that whole model has been brought into question over the last few years, last 3 or 4 years, and foreign policy is now much more a driver of development cooperation all over Europe, as well as what we see in the US. So what we've seen in the US is very dramatic, but it's really not that different from what you're seeing in many other Western donors. The question therefore is, well, why is this happening? Well, what happened to development cooperation? For 25 years, we had great relationships, these institutions were being built, and now why are Western donors pulling back? I think there are four reasons. First one is that since about the middle of the last decade, I'd say about 2015 or so, it became harder to show the kind of progress that I mentioned happened earlier between 1990 and 2015. More and more poor people were concentrated in countries that were in conflict or in marginalized communities. We didn't really have a very good way of helping them improve their living standards. So the results started to look less attractive. Secondly, other worries came to the front, to center stage. So in Europe, migration became a big issue. Climate change and its impact became a big issue. Conflicts and how to deal with them, and fragility, disease, and COVID came along and hit us. And so all of these things are important, but by focusing on them, it took the eye away from focusing on development cooperation. Third thing I think that happened is that development cooperation got caught in the backlash against globalization more generally. We had this 25-year period when we were all for globalization, for interdependence. And over the last 10 years, 15 years, we've started to rethink just how much we want to be interdependent with the rest of the world. And we started to see some of the costs of that during COVID. And somehow development and developing countries began to be seen more as competitors than as places to help. And I think the last thing is that the very model of development cooperation that we've been using since 1990 started to come under more and more criticism. You heard voices from Africa, from Latin America, saying, look, this model is, it just promotes aid dependence rather than self-reliance. We don't want to be dependent on getting aid flows. And people in rich countries started saying that this model, we're not quite sure what it's doing. It's trying to do too many different things. I always find this statistic helpful that in Sweden and the UK, let's take Sweden, the largest recipient of Swedish aid was Sweden. So the biggest chunk of their aid budget was actually being spent within Sweden, mostly to pay the hotel bills of the refugees that came and stayed in Sweden. Now, it's a good thing to pay the hotel bills of refugees who were in there. But to say that this was promoting development in Africa was a hard sell. And I think people started losing credibility from that. So for all of these reasons, when politicians started diverting the money from aid to other kinds of activities, from development assistance, there wasn't really as much of a pushback as you would have expected, say, a decade ago or longer. Now, the last thing I want to say about the past is that while the US and Europe, we were losing faith in the model of development cooperation, we were pulling back our programs, China was actually stepping up its involvement in the rest of the world. So when the history of the 20th century is going to be written, second half of the 20th century, you know, a big chunk of it will be about this extraordinary transformation of China from being a poor, rural country with largely uneducated people. Within two or three generations, it becomes the largest or second largest economy in the world, depending on how you measure it. It becomes the factory of the world, and it becomes a driver of innovation. But within the development area, that same transformation has meant that China, from being a few generations ago a large recipient of development assistance, is now the largest bilateral creditor for other developing countries, biggest trading partner, and a big presence in their economic and social fabric. And I don't think we realize here just how much of a presence it is. There is 80,000 African students now studying in Chinese universities. There's 10,000 plus Chinese businesses in Africa. So that's more African students in China studying at universities than there are studying in the US. And I think this is reshaping the nature of how they think about the presence of China as a player in their own societies. So where do we go next after all this? So we're clearly at a point where we've lost a bit of faith in the model we had. Economies have not been doing well in the last 10 years. After 25 years of great progress, you see 10 years of slowing down or stagnation. And the first question worth asking is, what is the next 25 years going to be like the last 10? Kind of muddling through, no progress. Or is it going to be like the 25 that came before? It's impossible to say which of the two it's going to be, but I can think of at least some forces that are going to be driving that outcome. So on the positive side, the biggest driver that's going to make the next 25 more like the 25 years of 1990 to 2015 is the effect of technology, which is spreading so rapidly across developing countries. And if you just think about one dimension of that, which is the price of an accessibility of renewable energy, solar energy now. Solar energy is 90% cheaper than it used to be. It's actually made it feasible for many countries and many households and communities in Africa to afford electricity, which they couldn't before. We just didn't have any way of providing it at scale or at the cost that we had. So you can just see that technology could make a difference. AI, a bit less clear about where it's going to be in terms of its, and how quickly we're going to see the positive impact. But if you think about AI, we worry here about job displacement. What does that mean for the jobs that people do? Well, if you're in a rural area in Africa, you know, you can use AI to provide teaching, to provide medical help. There aren't any jobs to be displaced. There's no teachers, there's no doctors that are going to be worried about getting displaced. So I think it's much more of a plus in terms of applications of AI in those environments than it's likely to be here where we're worrying about job displacement. But there's a couple of forces that I think might will make it harder. One is climate change. You can see the effect of rising sea levels. Oh, you can worry about the rising sea levels here. Yesterday we were seeing the little marker by the boatyard in Belfast, which tells you what's the likely effect of sea level increases here in Maine. But there are whole countries. Think of Bangladesh, think of the Maldives, think of small islands in the Pacific that are just worried about what that will mean for population shift. And you can see the effect of climate change is just making it much harder. When you have to build schools that are going to be resilient at 100 plus degrees in the summer, it's going to cost more to build the roads and the schools and make them usable for much hotter summers, much drier periods, much more uncertain climate. So climate change is making the cost of making progress harder for countries. The other is geopolitics. Geopolitics has always been in the background, but now is right in the foreground. And countries that are trying to develop have to navigate a much more complex set of international rules and norms, and the norms are changing. There's more uncertainty about, they're being asked to say, well, who are they going to be partners with? And if I'm partnering with you, do I worry about what this means about my partnership with you instead, you know, with somebody else? Am I still able to work within an agreed set of norms? That'll make it a bit harder. The bottom line of this for me is that we're likely to see much more diversity in economic and social progress across the world. That 1990-25 period when there was a rising tide that lifted all boats or most boats except for the ones that were in conflict or wedged in a particularly hard spot, I think we're going to see much less of the general improvement, much more of the specific improvement depending on individual countries. It's always been, talking about developing countries, it makes less and less sense. It's always been a little bit of a generalization because countries are so different. But if you think about the future, take countries like Brazil or India or Indonesia. These are going to be big global players. They want to be treated as global players, and we're going to have to engage with them on the terms of being countries whose actions will have regional and global impact. Then there's another 100 or so countries that are middle income. They're not poor, they're not rich. They're in between, they themselves have a widespread. And I think these countries, there'll be lots of variation amongst them, but they're going to find ways to work with each other to attract investment, to grow. Some will go faster than others. For us, what matters is that the decisions that these countries make will be the drivers of the global growth that we see. That's where all the investment in new infrastructure is going to happen mostly. The choice of technology that they use will determine what kind of temperature we end up with globally. So India is going to have 5 times more air conditioning by 2050 than it does today. If they use, think about the air conditioning sets that, you know, we get AC units at home, how much more efficient they are today than the ones that we're replacing that we bought 15 years ago. Which of the units that are going to be installed in Africa and in Asia? Are they going to be the ones that are high efficiency, or are they going to be the ones that have the efficiency ratings of 15 years ago? And if so, how much more carbon dioxide are they going to be emitting as a result? So the policy choices of these middle-income countries will drive global growth and global outcomes more than anything else. And then I really worry about the poorest countries. The World Bank says there's about 26 low-income countries. These are countries that have less than $1,400 per capita per year. But here's the worrying part. They also say that in 2050, so 25 years from now, 21 of these 26 countries will still be low income. There'll be no real improvement in their living standards. 700 million people live in their average age 17. So I worry about a world where 700 million people are living in countries where there is no prospect for improvement for a whole generation. Because I don't see that how it's possible for that to coexist with a peaceful and secure existence for everybody else. So I think we do need to figure out a way for that. So let's then finish up on what does all this mean for the US? And, you know, I guess let me put it in a question mark. You know, can we afford in the US not to engage with these countries over the next generation? Can we afford not to? Can we be indifferent to the choices that are made by the middle-income countries, by the terms on which they engage with each other, by the technology and financing that they have? And can we be indifferent to the poorest countries? Whereas I say that on current trajectories, there's going to be no improvement for 25 years. Now, you can guess my answer to it. But I think that while the system is changing, there are 3 compelling reasons why not just the US, but all rich and poor countries have to cooperate. The first is, I really do think that we're now in a period where we're too quick to write off human solidarity as a motive for engagement. In fact, if you do survey after survey in rich countries, in the US, in Europe, people are ready to help others who are facing humanitarian consequences or they're living in extreme poverty. In the US, recent survey shows 3/4 of the people who responded are in favor of the US providing medical help, humanitarian assistance, food assistance to people who are in difficulty. Actually, and I was surprised, 66% of them are also in favor of helping countries grow economically and become more effective, self-reliant, so they're willing to support that. I think there's more questioning of how we do it rather than whether we do it. So many of the people that are in favor of supporting countries still have questions about the programs and the effectiveness, but there's no question about solidarity. The second reason is just shared challenges. We're not going to be able to isolate ourselves from not just climate change, which I talked about, but talk about health security. Right now, CDC is helping to monitor and cope with an outbreak of Ebola in the Democratic Republic of Congo and spreading over to cases in Uganda this week. And we cannot, if those, the only way for us to be safe is to contain epidemics where they happen rather than to allow them to spread when we then end up with a much bigger problem. So disease doesn't stop at borders, similarly conflict, similarly climate. So for shared challenges, we have to find ways to work together to do it. And finally, we will work with other countries because we have mutual interest, whether we're trying to secure supply chains, whether we're trying to secure our own energy security for the longer term. There are reasons why countries will find a reason to work together. So I think there's no question in my mind that the U.S., like any other country, is going to find that it has to and wants to work with other countries. But the way we work with them is going to be different because the world is going to be different. So it's not a question, I think, to go back to what we had. It's a question of recognizing that we are now in a world of not being the only hegemon. So we're not the single driver of global progress. It's going to be a multipolar world in which developing countries themselves will be operating with many frameworks of cooperation at one time. And we will have to come forward with what is our offer? What is it that we bring to the table? And our offer can't only be couched in what we would like. It has to be also couched in terms of what we offer, what we bring to the table. And that has to be an offer that is attractive enough for our partners. But that offer becomes stronger if we work in a coalition of like-minded countries. And that is why many of our traditional allies on development cooperation, who are going through the same kind of calculus in their minds, if we can come together, then we can craft an offer for what we bring to the table that will become much more compelling for our partners. So let me end by just saying that I don't think we're coming to the end of development cooperation. Some people have said, well, that's the end of development. No, in my view, we're coming to the end of a particular model of development cooperation that was itself a product of a unique moment in our international global history. We're now transitioning to a different modern cooperation. The choice for the U.S. is not between trying to reestablish the old model or opting out of it. We're going to figure out the real choice is, well, how are we going to engage in the new model? And in that new model, we have to recognize that we're not going to be the only players. There are others, including and particularly China, who are going to be active players. But the fact that there are multiple players doesn't mean that there is going to be no progress, and it certainly doesn't mean that we don't have anything to offer, as long as we are clear-eyed and clear-headed about what we bring to the table and what we would like to see, both in terms of doing good for others and in terms of doing good for our own future generations. So let me stop with that. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Masoud. You're actually a little more positive than a lot of speakers we have. So that's a good to once in a while to get somebody who doesn't have totally negative message for us. I always take the opportunity of the moderator to ask the first question while we're collecting questions from our people who are here today. I was thinking as you were speaking, you talked about the fact that foreign assistance, not just U.S., but other countries, is being more and more tied to foreign policy, maybe security issues. I think a lot of us have often thought of foreign aid in terms of the soft power element, that is the ability to win friends and influence people. What effect does all of this have on soft power aspect of foreign aid? You know, is it going to continue, or are we kind of, is that a dead issue at this point?
I think it sort of depends in my mind on how broadly you define soft power. So you can think of it very narrowly in terms of saying, you know, I want to use this foreign aid to achieve this very specific foreign policy objective I have. And historically, if you go back to the period of the Cold War, that's how we often thought about foreign assistance at the time. That is, you know, very directly linked to some kind of foreign policy objective. We'll reward our allies, and we're going to try and get a particular kind of objective. Results were pretty mixed from that. We discovered it didn't really keep our allies by our side when we thought we were buying their friendship. But soft power can also become from having a much broader definition in terms of saying that you are seen as doing things which are driving progress and improving living conditions in a set of countries, and that brings you goodwill from that engagement. And I think from that point of view, as long as we continue to do it right, I don't see any reason why that would change.
A couple of questions already here as I start through these.
Well, it's a good collection of questions.
Well, we have a pretty active audience here. On the Chinese assistance programs, one is Chinese aid equal loans, and U.S. aid is mostly just assistance provided without a repayment. How do we do it in the future? Do we become totally transactional? Or are we going to be more like the Chinese, if they're having more influence with the way they do it?
I don't think there's a direction where if we become purely transactional in our aid, that would be helpful for us. I don't think that's the direction for us to be going. I think our strength has come from being there to support countries. Sometimes there's an element of an immediate quid pro quo, but sometimes it's because we are there for a longer term objective of trying to improve living conditions. So I think if we wander down the road of becoming purely transactional, we'd run the risk of then not having any kind of support when we need help either.
Somebody wants to know if you can actually point to two or three success stories of economic development where foreign aid has really played a crucial role. You talked about it in a broad sense. Are there some particular countries that have benefited the most from this?
I think that the obvious examples that people refer to, often when you ask them that, is to go back to East Asia. Talk about countries like Korea or Philippines, which were at a time, and Taiwan, you remember there were the Asian tigers. It's only 40, 50 years ago that these countries were in much worse state than they are today. I'm not sure that using only those countries as examples is very helpful for today, because the world we live in today is very different from the world in which Korea and Taiwan did well. But even if you look at Africa, you find countries like Morocco, you find countries like Rwanda, you find countries like Ghana that have done well and benefited from aid.
And how about a country like Haiti? Why hasn't anyone been able to help the Haitians in their situation?
It's a very difficult question, because I think what Haiti demonstrates to us is that our model doesn't really deliver in particularly complex societies where the internal foundations of that society are more and more under stress and fractured. And you could ask the same question in a different scale to other countries in Africa. Look at what's been happening in the Sahel countries, in Niger and Chad and in Burkina Faso, where we've had a series of coups that have taken place over the last few years. And where our model to try and help those countries or help the people in those countries hasn't worked. And where our model doesn't work particularly is where governments themselves are not focused on helping improve living conditions for the vast majority of population, because we find it hard. And I'm not sure that we have a very good solution on how to help from the outside when the country itself is struggling to get its act together.
Well, I keep getting more and more questions related to China. One is, how much of the Chinese resurgence, the growth of China, can be traced to development funds it received as opposed to just internal, straightening things out internally?
I think unambiguously the principal driver of Chinese progress has been internal mobilization of saving. China saves a huge amount of its income and invests a huge amount of its income. So that's a big driver of Chinese progress, but also of Chinese government's reforms over the 1980s, 90s, 2000, the way they moved from being primarily agrarian, a rural economy, to building enterprises, the way in which they took on board infrastructure developments. I think the big difference was that, and this is where I feel the World Bank, where I used to work for many years, the World Bank played a really important role in supporting the economic progress of China in its early phase, is by the Chinese were very interested in how the rest of the world was solving particular problems. And they used the World Bank as a way of bringing in the best practice from the rest of the world on everything from how to organize enterprises, to how to do markets for agricultural products, to how to organize local government finances. And they were very eager and serious about learning from the experience of the world. And that's where institutions like the World Bank have a real comparative advantage. In the end, the money's important, but it's really more than the money for middle-income countries. It's the ability to bring the benefit of the global experience that they have, which most countries' policymakers struggle to keep abreast of.
Then I have a couple of questions here also on how well do the large private NGOs coordinate with governments, and what role do they play in development, world development?
Large private NGOs, in many countries, have filled the gap which governments have not been able to provide. So if you think about BRAC in Bangladesh, it's a huge NGO providing education, helping women, particularly access credit, microcredit. So BRAC has become a huge provider of this. You look at a country in like Pakistan, you have an NGO which is called the Citizens Foundation, which provides secular education for 300,000 children who would otherwise be out of school. And many of these kids, you know, I see them there going now to the best US universities. They've come out of they come from families where nobody had seen the inside of a school forever, to being now teaching it at US university. So you see that kind of gap. But for all those strengths, at the end of the day, NGOs cannot become what we rely on for promoting development in countries. At the end of the day, countries, government, state capacity has to drive the principal social services that we have here that everybody else expects.
And what about the role of international organizations such as the UN? Do they, in your future world, play a major part or less, a lesser part?
Look, I think we're going to have international organizations that come together to bring countries together to solve problems that you can't solve individually or bilaterally. What will be the future role of the UN? What shape will it take? And if you watch, I mean, I'm cautious about what I say on this, but if you watch how much power the UN has been able to exercise to shape the behavior of its principal members over the last decade, you would have to see a step up of major proportions for us to imagine that in the future, these institutions will be the places where you can drive collective change. I think what role they do play, and which we tend to think of, is that they do help to create norms. And it's hard to see those norms that have been created being created in other fora in the same way. I like to use the example of the International Postal Union, you know, a place which allows for, which was created when the world was fighting, lots of Soviet Union, and we had all these blocks in the world that couldn't communicate, but we were able to send letters across. And the reason is that you needed to have a framework within which you came together to be able to post letters across borders.
You commented in your talk that the world is looking ahead into the reality of multiple alliances collective agreements, and the absence of the U.S. as the major hegemon. Should we expect then a period of greater instability while all this is happening?
I think we should expect a period of greater messiness. It's going to be messier, it's going to be more uncertain, there'll be multiple overlapping alliances, there'll be networks, and sometimes they'll include governments, but they might also include corporations. And I think we're just going to be going through a period where it won't be quite so neat. So if you think about it, we've been going through a period, if you step back, where it was neat and structured and generally implemented as design. Then we've moved over the last, I would say, 30 years or so it was a neat and structured design, but the implementation was more at variance with the design, where you could actually point to examples where we weren't following the rules that we had created. And now I think we're moving to a period where we're going to recognize that the way we operate, which is messy and overlapping, is what should be reflected in the design, rather than pretend that we've got a design that we are deviating from. We're sort of letting go more and more of the design that we have of the frameworks, and just trying to make the best in a messy and less structured set of relationships.
I think you may have just have answered this question, but I want to ask it again in a different way. How best should the U.S. return to the type of full engagement with international development that we had before? Or is it best just to accept the new world as it is and move forward?
I think it's both, because I think we have to return to engagement with development and developing countries for the reasons that I believed, the reason I set out, you know, because we think we care about what happens to the people who are most unfortunate. There are global problems we can't solve without engaging with them, and we have relationships that are helpful to us as well as to them. So we're going to have to do it. The question is more, it can't be done the way it used to be done in the past, because the world is different, and so we have to come up with a framework in which, in the world in which we are going to have to engage, we can do so effectively and in a way that is seen as being helpful and constructive by our partners. Because at the end of the day, if they don't find our offer attractive, We're not the only offer in town.
And there were a couple of questions related to investment and how we should structure it all. And one question is, how much of this rising tide from 1990 to 2015 was driven by aid, and how much was driven by a travel and investment? And how should then we structure investment in the future to best promote development?
Right. Look, aid is small. Total amount of aid is $200 billion a year. Right? That's in the scheme of global finance, it's a tiny amount. And so it's not the financing of aid that drives progress. It's what comes with it. And it's by targeting, using it where the other forms of finance don't reach. Remittances are 5 times larger than aid. Private capital flows in any country on any given day, you have literally trillions of dollars moving across borders, right? So I don't think that it's the financing that matters to middle-income countries. As I said, I don't think Brazil really cares one way or the other whether we have some small amount of aid flows going there, because it doesn't make much difference to their balance of finance. But in the poorest countries, in trying to deal with programs where there is no other form of financing available, aid can be super helpful. But what is really helpful with it is the way in which it helps to bring the best practice on how to make progress. And it's the market access, international trade, open economies. And that's why, you remember, I started off by saying that to me, the bigger role the US played in supporting global development has been as the keeper of an rules-based international system which allows for people, countries, to invest with more certainty, to trade with each other, and to be able to grow their economies through being part of a global economy. That is what is going to drive progress, which also means it's really only private enterprise that's going to do it. Governments aren't going to be the ones that are producing things to export, but they are the ones who create the framework within which private companies can either do it or get held back.
Here's an issue that always comes up with aid programs. Many first world countries have significant areas of poverty themselves. How can the first world balance helping the developing world while still improving the quality of life for its own impoverished citizens?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think that one of the things we have to recognize is the amounts of money we're talking about are a small, minuscule fraction of what we actually spend or could spend on domestic programs to fight poverty. I don't see these two as the obvious trade-offs. Should you be spending money on tackling poverty within your own country? Absolutely sure. Is the only way to finance that by cutting back on the finance, on the programs for international assistance that we have, or are there other bits in our budget where we could find ways to finance those programs? I think that's the question. And in our minds, we make that trade-off without stopping on the way to say, is that the only place from which we could draw it? And that's the same question, for example, people now raise to say, look, we need all this money to fight climate change, right? And can we really afford to be doing development when we should be fighting climate change? We need 5 times the amount that we spend on development globally to make a dent on climate change. We could take it all away and just wouldn't make any difference. We need to, if we want to fight climate change, for example, then you need to mobilize the resources to do that. But I don't see the one-to-one trade-offs in the same way.
Here's some of the notes, the fact that Chinese think in terms of millennia, the long term, whereas the U.S. thinks in terms of 2 and 4 year increments. How do we change this short-term thinking of the United States in a way that could really help us in the long term?
I'm not sure I have a better answer to that than anyone else in this room. It is certainly the case that a lot of our expectations of change are at odds with the experience of how long it takes to change and develop, and most importantly, bring about the generational mindset changes. See, you may think the Chinese think of in millennia, but they tend to achieve things much faster. And I think what we have to think about is ways in which we can think long term, but we can act quickly, more quickly. And what worries me is that often in the time frame, maybe it's the way we've organized ourselves in Europe and here in the US, it's harder to make strategic decisions quickly. Whether it's infrastructure projects or building an airport. And I remember an example that in the UK, they've been talking about building a third runway at Heathrow Airport. I think they've been talking about it for 3 or 4 decades. And in that time, there's a lot of runways being built elsewhere.
And then is there a single issue that you could, that could pull the world together in some fashion so that we, if there is such an issue, what do you think it might be? Is there something that can really bring people together?
I think that, to my mind, I'm personally coming more and more to believe in is educating the next generation. I think that we could come together to ensure that even today, every child that is born, first of all, survives through the age of 5, gets the access to vaccination, vitamin A, and basic nutrients that will ensure that it doesn't remain stunted with a brain that only functions at 60% capacity for the rest of their lives. And all this is happening before they get to school. And so when they get to school, they're a school-ready child. And I think that is where, if we can come together and do that, we have a hope that 25 years from now, the kids that are growing up will be the ones that will be in a better place to solve the problems that maybe we will just be happy to pass on to them.
I think with that, we'll finish it up. We thank you very, very much.